From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how President Biden's reversal of the so-called Muslim ban is being received by Michigan's communities.
They see this as a victory, but they also see it as a vindication that the excuses that were provided by the Trump administration for the ban were not valid.
Plus, the Michigan Supreme Court debate over absentee ballots during the Civil War.
The idea of voting anywhere other than where you lived was a pretty foreign concept because of concerns about fraud and preserving the purity of the ballot.
And a grocery store tackles food insecurity in Grand Rapids with tools from social justice.
Right now we've got blue potatoes and delicata squash and rainbow radishes, all from local farms.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. The food that we eat plays a huge role in our physical and mental health. But finding healthy options isn't always easy, especially for folks in marginalized communities. Later in the show, we'll talk about new models for tackling food insecurity in vulnerable parts of Michigan.
We really believe that it's not just going to be, you know, a vaccine or a food handout that's going to support people. It's going to be the long-term change and support to their health.
That's later in the show. But first, President Joe Biden signed a stack of executive orders yesterday afternoon to kick off his agenda in the White House. And included in that stack was an end to the Trump-era travel ban on several Muslim-populated countries, the so-called Muslim travel ban. With us to talk about the relatively short life cycle of this very controversial measure is Ali Harb, political reporter for The Middle East Eye and native of Dearborn. Ali, welcome back to Stateside.
Hello, April. Thank you for having me.
Were you very surprised to see this executive order at the top of the list for Joe Biden's agenda?
No, I was not, because President Biden has promised repeatedly that the order would be scrapped on day one. And pretty much every Democratic presidential candidate since the primaries had made that promise as well. But it was refreshing to actually see the president follow on that promise, on that vow that he made to the Muslim community. And it was just something to celebrate that this policy was overturned.
What have you been hearing from Muslim Americans and officials, and maybe even from folks outside U.S. borders?
People are jubilant and happy, especially the activists, the lawyers, the organizers who have been fighting the ban, have been pushing back against the ban. They see this as a victory, but they also see it as a vindication that the excuses that were provided by the Trump administration for the ban were not valid, that indeed it was a Muslim ban, that indeed it was discriminatory, that indeed it was motivated by religious animus. There is a sense of this is a step towards a greater campaign for reform in immigration laws and discriminatory statutes.
So with COVID still spreading across the world, what does this measure change about pandemic-related travel restrictions? Do you think we're going to see people jumping on planes right away?
Necessarily not. The restrictions that are COVID-related will remain in place. Last week, there was a new regulation that all newcomers in the United States have to provide a negative COVID test. But as far as family reunification goes, it will speed up the process. It will expedite the process. And I think despite the travel restrictions that have been ushered by the pandemic, immigration visas can be issued and, you know, people would have to get a test or people would have to wait to be vaccinated. These details can be worked out. But the spirit of resuming the processing of family reunification visas, of urgent travel visas, of student visas, that is insignificant on its own.
Ali, it's common practice for presidents to undo some of the rules and regulations from previous administration if they find them just really egregious or counter to their own agendas. That said, do you worry at all about a future president reinstituting the idea of a travel ban? Or is that something you're hearing from people that they might be concerned about?
I mean, absolutely, that is a worry, because we've seen a bit of a whiplash over the past, shall we say, 4 years between Trump undoing a lot of President Obama's policies, the Paris Climate Agreement, the Iran deal, and then Biden undoing some of Trump's policies. What was telling yesterday and this morning is that the Republicans who defended and vehemently stood by President Trump's travel ban, they were nowhere to be seen to oppose its reversal. And this sort of tells us that the mainstream Republican Party knew all along that it's not about national security, that it's not a valid ban, that it's not rooted in science or guided policy, that it was motivated by bigotry. And that's why they're not here to say, you know, why are you reversing it? So that gives us a bit of hope that the mainstream Republican Party is not, you know, standing by the ban, defending it now that Trump is gone.
President Trump took office with a lot of harsh rhetoric for terrorism. And what he meant by that was extremists from Muslim-majority countries or even Muslim Americans. But the United States has gotten a harsh reminder recently that terrorism can and has looked like any number of radicalized people. Do you think that the mob at the Capitol will change the conversation at this in this time about the new crop of domestic terrorism?
I think it certainly has already. It has been, you know, changing the focus of the national security priorities. And the mob, the invasion of the Capitol, such a visible demonstration of a threat that folks have been talking about for decades. You know, the far right threat. We've seen synagogues get shot. We've seen mosques get bombed. We've seen Sikh temples get shot. So people both on right and the left are starting to see that the biggest national security threat is far right violence, is white supremacist violence. That said, many people in the civil rights community, including Muslim American organizers, are sort of sounding the alarm about expanding the definition of terrorism, because they know that once we give national security agencies more resources to fight far right violence under the counterterrorism strategy, that could come back one day to harm people of color, to harm Muslim communities.
You were at the Capitol on January 6th, working. Can you tell us a little bit about what was going through your mind as you watched some of the chaos, and maybe just where you were and if you were in a safe place?
So I was on the west side of the Capitol by the steps, where there were scaffoldings and the rioters had climbed all over the scaffoldings. And frankly, at the moment, not much was going on through my mind other than, you know, making my observations and taking my notes and speaking to people. I wasn't examining the political significance of the moment. It wasn't until, you know, hours later, if not the next day, that it sort of just started to set in, everything that was happening. But it was utter chaos. It was unbelievable. I saw people walking in and out of the Capitol, and I kept thinking to myself, how's this happening? Like the ease with which the Capitol was breached was mind-boggling. Just people screaming, move forward, people in protesters, rioters, insurrectionists, whatever we want to call them, in sort of military fatigue and GoPro cameras. It seemed that many of the participants came prepared for some sort of violence. A great deal of the people who were at the riots also maybe just went with the flow. It was just something that was difficult to process in real time. So as I said, not much was going on through my head other than just taking it in a little bit.
Yeah. You're still in D.C. What has the city looked like since then?
Well, it's so that the riots happened on Wednesday. We woke up on Thursday and there was a fence around the Capitol. There were thousands of National Guardsmen and women military vehicles on every corner. And soon after, pretty much the entirety of the National Mall, which is the stretch between the Capitol and the Lincoln Memorial that has government buildings and museums, pretty much sealed off to the public. The metro, which connects DC to its surrounding suburbs, the stops in central DC stopped working. So it was a pretty extraordinary thing that was happening, the over-securitization of DC. I mean, granted, there were warranted security concerns, but it was still very strange and bizarre to witness.
One last thing. Another executive order that Joe Biden signed yesterday halted deportations. Deportation policies in the past 4 years have really affected Michigan's Latino and Chaldean communities, really pretty specifically. Have you heard any reaction yet from Chaldean folks about this reversal?
I mean, a lot of Chaldeans who supported President Biden and those who were immediately affected by Trump's deportation campaign, I saw social media posts welcoming the moratorium on deportations. But, you know, with the moratorium of deportation came an order to review the immigration enforcement practices that they are in line with, quote unquote, American values. So these are amazing steps to be taken on day ones. We think of immigration as a Latino issue, but it's an issue that touches every community. So this was a very positive development. And I think a lot of the focus went to the Muslim ban, just because of how volatile this Trump executive order was and how important it was to reverse it on day one. But the pause on deportation is just as, if not more, significant.
Ali Harb is a reporter for the Middle East Eye, and he's joining us from his present assignment in Washington, D.C. Ali, it's good to hear your voice. Thank you.
Thank you, April.
The first time absentee voting was widely used in Michigan, it was pretty controversial, and justices of the Michigan Supreme Court had a hard decision on their hands.
They were extremely sensitive to the fact that if they were to deny the soldiers' vote, men who were in the field dying for the Union cause were being disenfranchised.
The outcome of the case stands as an example of putting aside partisanship for democratic ideals. We'll tell you the story after a break. Stick with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. It was an election year in a divided America. Tens of thousands of absentee ballots were sent out by the state. And eventually, the Michigan Supreme Court weighed in. Now, before you say, yes, April, I remember all this from last year, I'm not talking about the 2020 election, but rather the election of 1864. Joining us to tell the story is the president of the Michigan Supreme Court Historical Society, Carl Herstein. Carl, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So, 1864 was a pivotal year in the American Civil War. Was the re-election of Abraham Lincoln, who was a Republican, was that already a foregone conclusion?
No, not at all. The war had been going on for a long time, having started several years before. Things hadn't been going particularly well, despite various Union victories in 1863, and there was tremendous war weariness in the land. In addition to that, the Democratic Party in the North was particularly tired of the war, and there was considerable interest in trying to find a way to bring about peace, even if that meant letting the southern states leave the Union permanently.
Sometimes it's hard to remember the scale of the war effort. More than 2 million people were mobilized for the Union Army in the North. I take it that voting was a big problem for these soldiers?
Yes, that's right. Michigan had provided 90,000 troops over the course of the war. That's a lot of people, obviously, in a population the size of Michigan at that time. There really was very limited history with respect to voting anywhere other than in your place of residence. The concept of an absentee ballot was really something very, very new. There had been a little bit of soldier voting during the revolution in New York, and there actually had been a statute allowing soldier voting outside their place of residence in Pennsylvania during the War of 1812. But other than that, the idea of voting anywhere other than where you lived was a pretty foreign concept, and one that was of great concern to both the citizens and the court because of concerns about fraud and preserving the purity of the ballot, as they used to say.
So what was Michigan's solution once election time rolled around?
Well, Michigan, like many of the other northern states, decided for both practical and principled reasons that it should try to allow the soldiers to vote. By the time of 1864, almost all of the northern states, one way or another, enacted either legislation or constitutional amendments to allow their soldiers to vote in the field. Now, that could take one of two forms. The form it took in Michigan was based on what was called the Iowa model, where they actually essentially brought the polling place to the soldiers. They had commissioners, and the soldiers actually cast their ballots in the field as if they were in their polling places at home. A few other states followed a different model, more like our absentee ballots today, where they actually sent in a ballot that was counted at their polling place at home.
What was the critique of absentee balloting at that time?
The concern was the possibility of fraud in the first instance, but also there was a concern about intimidation of the soldiers in the field. And both things turned out to have some merit to them. There were numerous examples of officers and others exerting influence on the troops to try to get them to vote for continuation of the war effort. As you might imagine, tempers ran very high with the Civil War raging and these troops potentially dying for the Union cause. At the same time, there was concern about false ballots and things of that sort. And there was some of that both on the Republican and Democrat side. There was actually a ring of people associated with the state of New York that was uncovered and prosecuted where they were trying to falsify absentee voter votes for Lincoln's opponent, General George B. McClellan.
The election did take place as scheduled, and there were some really, really close races that year in Michigan. How did the courts get involved?
Well, actually, the courts were involved in many of the different states because constitutional and practical complaints were made. There were actually 9 courts that weighed in on the issue, and Michigan was the last of the 9. The concern was that the Constitution in each of these states imposed restrictions on voting. And the question was really a fairly simple one. Were the constitutional restrictions in a particular state intended simply to limit the qualifications for voting? In other words, did you have to be a citizen of a particular state over 21 and so forth? Or did they also regulate the place of voting and the manner of voting? And different state constitutions had different rules with respect to these things, as did Michigan.
It was interesting looking at how this case was presented to the Michigan Supreme Court. The arguments didn't really touch on political pressures within the Army ranks, but instead drilled down on this constitutional question of whether people could vote outside of the precinct in which they resided.
Yes, and to understand why that was, you have to understand the makeup of the Michigan Court. The Michigan Supreme Court consisted of 4 justices at that time, all of whom were Republicans. And this was obviously an extremely difficult issue for a Republican court because it had been the Republican Party which had pushed soldier voting in Michigan, led by the state's attorney general, who was the one who was handling the particular case at issue. And therefore, as they pointed out in some of the opinions, this was not a case where their sentiments were in tune with what they felt their constitutional duty was.
The justices ultimately decided that the state did not have the authority to send out all those absentee ballots. But it kind of sounds like even the majority justices didn't really agree with each other. Can you explain where they were coming from?
Most of the justices were in agreement that the constitutional language did not allow for voting to be held outside the place where a person resided. But there were sort of different angles taken with respect to why that constitutional decision had to be made. Justice Cooley, for example, looked to a technical flaw that existed in connection with the Soldier Voting Act, which failed to talk about the exact jurisdiction in which the votes had to be returned. And he was able to point to that as a flaw in the statute. The other justices looked either to the history as to why Michigan's constitution should be interpreted as requiring vote in the jurisdiction in which you resided to various degrees. You could look at the language itself and draw conclusions from that. You could look at the history and draw conclusions from that. You could look at the decisions from other states and draw conclusions from that. But I think, to answer your question more fully, I think one of the reasons that the three justices who voted to invalidate the act wrote separately is because each wanted to establish their sincerity and their honest judicial feelings as to why they needed to vote against something that probably each of them personally favored and that their party strongly favored.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Carl Hurstein. He is president of the Michigan Supreme Court Historical Society, and we're talking about the contested elections of 1864, the first in Michigan in which large numbers of absentee ballots were in play. Carl, were final election tallies changed as a result of the court's decision?
Well, that's an interesting question. In this particular case, it actually certified the result of the election of the prosecuting attorney for the county of Washtenaw, because in certifying the election, the canvassers had actually rejected the soldier's vote. So it really didn't change the decision in Washtenaw County, where if they had counted the soldier vote, Twitchell, who was the challenger, would have won as opposed to Blodgett, the incumbent. But interestingly enough, there was a follow-up decision to this particular decision of the court where they had to determine the question of whether votes taken in the state legislature could be overturned because some of the legislators had been elected due to soldier votes, which, if not counted, would have meant that their opponents would have won. Well, interestingly enough, the same court which decided the soldier voting case concluded that the state legislature had the right to determine the qualifications of its own membership, and therefore it refused to overturn a particular law that had been enacted by representatives who had, if you had not counted the soldier votes, would not have been certified as elected to the legislature. So a complicated legal result.
I'm guessing a lot of people who are listening to this right now voted last year via absentee ballot. How were the constitutional issues that the justices pointed out in the 1860s? How were those issues ultimately resolved?
Yes, certainly. What happened was that the following year in 1866, the people of the state of Michigan adopted a constitutional amendment, which allowed the legislature to make provision for things such as soldier voting. And so that was the beginning of an effort that you know, culminated in changes in the various state constitutions and implementing legislation, which allowed absentee ballots in, you know, a much wider variety of circumstances.
Looking back at this time, the Michigan Supreme Court was divided in its decision. The majority decision invalidated the votes of thousands of people who were fighting to preserve the union. I wonder how you feel the court's decision has worn over time.
I think that the decision is a testament to judicial independence. And in many ways, that's the way it's remembered. Clearly, it was a difficult decision to invalidate the votes of people who were putting their lives on the line for the union. And the three justices all expressed concern about that and indicated that a constitutional amendment would be appropriate. But what the most famous of the three justices said, Justice Cooley, I think is something that he would say is a principle that still applies today, which is that one needs to remember that the purpose of the Constitution is to stand as a bulwark against temporary feelings in times of passion. And that if it doesn't serve that purpose, the document is of little use in preserving our liberties. I think that was the general feeling of the court. I think that's how they would want to be remembered today with respect to that decision.
Carl, do you think that people understand the context of all of this? I sometimes wonder if we're in a period where folks are ready to look at and interpret history to suit what may be going on with them at any given time. And heaven knows this has been a year when a significant portion of the electorate has been looking for reasons to question absentee ballots. Do you think about how people understand the full background of what was going on at the time?
I would really urge people to actually read the decision if they're interested in what the court had to say. The court, starting in 1865, when Justice Cooley actually joined it, is considered the greatest court in the history of Michigan, with the most famous jurists that the state has ever produced. And the opinions written by that court from 1865 over the next 20 years are well worth reading and considering. The court was extremely thoughtful in how it dealt with this very difficult issue during the most difficult time in the history of our nation. Each of the justices tried very hard to balance the many difficult equities that they were facing. They were extremely sensitive to the fact that if they were to deny the soldiers' vote, men who were in the field dying for the Union cause were being disenfranchised. At the same time, they were well aware of the concerns that both parties had about potential fraud. They were concerned about the implications for the difference in the roles of the legislature versus its constitutional authority. And they were sensitive to the history behind the Constitution and the reason that the various provisions had been adopted. I think they made a very thoughtful effort, whether you agree with the decision that they made or not, to apply the Constitution as they believed it was intended by the people of the state. They looked to an understanding of the Constitution as to how they believed the people had adopted it, and that was their lodestar. And as I mentioned earlier, it was their belief that no matter how difficult the decision might be politically or personally, it was their obligation to follow the Constitution because it was intended to be the anchor of our liberty. as Justice Cooley indicated. And so I'm deeply impressed by the effort of the court to deal with this difficult issue and the thoughtfulness and the wisdom of the justices dealing with difficult circumstances and attempting to do their duty as they saw it, free from partisan political requirements, at a time when the country was engaged in a civil war, passions were at their height, and it was easy to be emotional rather than wise in making a decision.
Carl Herstein is the president of the Michigan Supreme Court Historical Society. Carl, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Up next, 2021 offers us some opportunities to expand access to healthy food.
They made do with what was at the convenience store, which is just not conducive to optimal health.
We'll have more on that in just a moment. We'll be back after a short break. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The pandemic has exacerbated societal stress points all across the board. Even one of our most basic needs, access to food. More people are experiencing food insecurity right now. A new store in Grand Rapids aims to address this gap with tools of intentional design. For example, could our food choices change when food labels are telling us more? Would you be likely to buy a subscription box of local veggies if you knew it was also helping feed others in your community? Alita Kelly is the founder of Southeast Market, which opened its doors on Martin Luther King Day. Alita, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Could you maybe walk us into Southeast Market, take us there through the magic of radio? When we walk into the storefront, what would I see? What would I smell? What kind of feel were you going for with the space?
Totally. So it's a very quaint space. And so when you walk in, you'll be greeted by one of our staff who is just as passionate about social justice and food justice as I am. And to the right, you'll see a window full of colorful local foods. Right now, we've got blue potatoes and delicata squash and rainbow radishes, all from local farms. We also have these tags that show just how far all of the food has come from, and that really signals how we are working to reduce our carbon footprint by sourcing local. And then if you walk around the rest of the store, you'll see an array of different items, dairy, shelf-stable grocery. All of them have these tags with an icon sticker on them to show where they're from and what type of business you're supporting. So whether that be a Black business or a female-led business or a local business, it's easy for the customer to see what they're supporting.
Alita, did you have a background in food retail when you started thinking about this?
Sure. So over the last several years, I've worked managing two nutrition programs in Grand Rapids through local nonprofits. Both of those programs were supporting vulnerable populations, and I also had a catering business. And then early last year, or May of 2020, I graduated from U of M with my degree in environmental science and sustainable business. So food justice, and that being closely tied to environmental justice and social justice, has been a passion of mine for quite some time. And while I was living here in Grand Rapids before I went to Ann Arbor to go to school, I always hoped that we could have some sort of store in my neighborhood where you could walk to, because I was learning about food access and the solution being, you know, put healthy food where people are, especially people that are financially challenged, who have higher risks of suffering from dietary related illness. And so I've been trying to imagine what this store looks like. And I'm so grateful that we're able to manifest that dream that not only I have, but many of our neighbors, into a reality now.
I feel like there are a lot of assumptions among people who don't experience food insecurity about, I guess, how this problem works. You know, if for folks living in a neighborhood that does not have grocery stores in close proximity stocking healthy food, well, you know, well, why don't people just drive to places where they can get fresh fruits and vegetables? Or why wouldn't they make the choices that, you know, that they need to make? But I mean, I have a feeling that a lot of people who do live in food deserts and experience insecurity are painfully aware of what's going on. What did you see happening in people's lives that you wanted to intervene in?
Totally. So a lot of my neighbors were doing their grocery shopping at Walgreens, which has no fresh food. They were saying that, you know, they have to work two jobs so they can make ends meet because they're making minimum wage. So after working, getting on the bus to go to Meijer, it was just, it was too much. And so they made do with what was at the convenience store, which is just not conducive to optimal health.
What are some of the things that are different when you're working with local food sources and Black, Indigenous, and people of color vendors and women-owned operations? How does that change the sort of interaction from what a more traditional grocery store might do?
Totally. So it's definitely a lot more about relationship building, because it's not just sending over an order form and then, you know, it comes the next day. We're learning about these farmers' lives, and we're able to share their stories and the unique challenges that they experience because of coming from their specific background. One example is that we have 1.4% of farmers in the United States are farmers of color, which is down from 1 in 7 at the beginning of the 19th century. So we're seeing a lot of land loss, and that land loss is caused by several different things, but we're able to share the stories with our followers and with our customers, so they feel good about the intentionality that they're making by coming in and supporting local, diverse food vendors through Southeast Market, and also translating all of that support back to farmers and food entrepreneurs and food businesses as well, to create this community around food and support.
Will you tell me about one of your producers?
Sure. So most of our fresh food, when it's in season, it's pretty cold right now in Michigan. And so we don't just source locally, but we also go outside of Michigan when the season requires. But Groundswell Farm is an organic farm in Zeeland, which is about 20 miles west of Grand Rapids. And it's led by Bruce Michael Wilson. He's a Black farmer, and he grows some of the best food that we've ever seen. Collard greens the size of your head, maybe three heads. beautiful garlic with these purple hues, and his stewardship of earth is so beautiful, and it's evident in all of the food that he provides to us. Full Hollow Farm is one that I'm really excited to have in the store. They're in Belding right now, and it's a fully organic farm, and they take such careful care of these vegetables and herbs, and again, it's so evident in how beautiful they are, and we're so proud to have them in the store.
Alita, for those who don't know Grand Rapids as well, will you tell us a little bit about the 49507 area and your service area?
Sure. So the 49507 zip code is one of the most diverse spaces in Grand Rapids. At the same time, it has a lot of residents that are suffering from dietary related illness, which we know at this point is one signifier of having a harder time recovering from COVID and increased odds at contracting COVID. And so people with diabetes and suffering from obesity and heart disease, the rates in 49507 are astronomical compared with the surrounding areas. And so COVID really, it really sent us off faster to tackle our mission because we know, me and my business partner, Kara, we really bonded over food as medicine. And we believe that one way we can support our community in this time during the pandemic is by helping people with dietary related illness get nutrient dense food, because we really believe that it's not just going to be, you know, a vaccine or a food handout that's going to support people. It's going to be the long term change and support to their health.
I know that one of the core ideas that you and your partner had for this was the concept of a learning market. Can you explain what that is?
Definitely. So one piece of the Southeast market that I'm really proud of is, and that a lot of people seem confused by, is we have food items that you might not necessarily associate with a health food store. So we have things like ramen noodles, and ramen noodles are by no means nutrient dense, but we serve ramen noodles there because we are honoring the experience that people have had living in food apartheid. And so we can't just show up and assume that everyone's going to know how to cook a delicata squash or work with rosemary. But by offering both things that they're used to and honoring their experience of living without healthy, fresh food in their neighborhood, we can bring the two together. So if someone checks out with, you know, just ramen noodles, we can share with them how awesome the meal would be and how they can pack so much more nutrients in their meal if they add these organic green onions or some local mushrooms that are a superfood, and how it's good for your immunity and your gut health. So we are doing our best to empower our staff to share what they know and to learn more through food so we can translate that into our community.
Southeast Market has a Pay It Forward program, which has an impact of increasing access even further to those who might not be able to afford it. Can you explain how it works?
Totally. So meat is one item that we haven't made any compromises on because we know that the benefits to eating local pastured meat are so great, and we want to make sure that that is accessible to everyone. And so Pay It Forward is a fund that our generous community supports and donates to. And we use those funds to sell all of our meat at cost to the customer, as well as produce from local Black organic farms.
Alita Kelly is the co-founder of Southeast Market in Grand Rapids. Alita, thank you so much for talking to us about this. I hope we can check in with you a year from now and find out how it's going.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
There's a program out of Michigan that's seen a huge spike in the need for food assistance during the pandemic. The Double Up Food Bucks program matches SNAP food assistance dollars when buyers spend at farmers markets and at certain grocery stores. This has been an option for folks using SNAP in Michigan for more than a decade, but supporters are hoping that Double Up could go even further with an ally leveling up in Congress. The creator of Double Up Food Bucks is Oren Hesterman. He's also CEO of the Fair Food Network. Oren, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, April. Good to be with you.
Do you feel as though the pandemic has shifted your perceptions about food justice in America?
You know, the COVID pandemic has really given us a wake-up call about the fragility of many of our supply chains, especially the one in which we all depend, and that's food. And it's really shown that we have a dual crisis. It's an economic crisis and it's a public health crisis, and food is right in the middle of all of it.
Yeah. The actions that used to be so commonplace, going to the grocery store, is now one of the few central things that is top of mind for all of us and around which I guess we structure our weekly lives. Would you say that that has had an impact on the Double Up Food Bucks program? Just how people are using it and when?
Yes, we have seen a huge impact on the Double Up Food Bucks program since the COVID pandemic started. One of those impacts has to do with shopping behaviors. But the really great impact is because since the beginning of 2020, we have seen a greater increase in SNAP or food stamp use and participation since the program started. So in the history of the program, we've never seen a growth in the number of households that are using the food stamp program in the amount of food stamp money that's actually moving through the system.
Well, what's the magnitude of that growth right now?
Between 2019 and 2020, if we look at the year as a whole, there was a doubling in the use of Double Up Food Bucks, two times as much used in the state of Michigan. And when we just looked at quarter two of 2019 versus quarter two of 2020, it was a four times increase, a quadrupling. I mean, it's not just a small percentage. It's, you know, doubling and quadrupling.
Oren, the last time you were with us, you talked about your goal to bring Double Up from individual partnership across 26 states to all 50, you know, a fully national program. There has been continued support from Senator Debbie Stabenow, and she has now reclaimed the role of chair for the U.S. Senate's Agriculture Committee. Do you think that that's going to improve your chances of expanding Double Up in the coming years?
We sure hope so. You know, as Senator Stabenow takes the helm of the Agriculture Committee, I'm confident that she will continue to champion the kind of bipartisan win-win solutions like Double Up, like nutrition incentives that can support farmers and the needs of hungry families. And this is happening at a really important time when the next farm bill will start to be debated. And I think it can serve as a really good example of igniting this kind of bipartisan support and using the power of food to create the kind of change we need in our communities for our farmers and for our families.
The chairmanship of the House Agriculture Committee has switched hands as well. And the chair is now David Scott of Georgia, who I believe is the first Black man to hold that position.
That's correct. What we've heard from Representative Scott is that nutrition is one of his highest priorities. And we know that's a priority for Senator Stabenow as well. But I think we shouldn't be mistaken that the work of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the committees that really help direct and fund that department are also about farming and agriculture. And we need to do a good job in supporting our local farmers and our agriculture in Michigan, in Georgia, and across the country.
It's good to be working on a program like that that has such broad appeal in both rural and urban communities. Still, I wondered if you could tell us if the increased polarization across our country has had any impact on the work that you do.
We have found, April, over the years of, you know, we're now about 12 years into the Double Up program. We started in 2009 with a small pilot at Detroit Eastern Market, and it is now spread across the state of Michigan and really across the country. And what we have found along the way is that this is one approach that has gotten bipartisan support across political parties and across ideologies ever since the start. It helps families that need healthy food get access to it. It puts those dollars in the pockets of local farmers, and it keeps those food dollars in the local community and the local economy, helping to create jobs and business opportunities in local communities. So this kind of win-win-win has, from the start, had support from Democrat and Republican, across the aisle, across ideologies, even at times where it seemed like the political divide was huge in this country. And I think it's really a hopeful sign. It shows us that when we have good ideas that are serving multiple folks and multiple communities, that our democracy can work to help keep those programs in place and grow them.
Well, Oren Hesterman, we thank you so much for talking with us today, and I hope we can touch base later this year and see what happened.
Would love to do that. Thank you so much for having me on today.
And that's Stateside for today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm April Baer. We'll catch you next time.